Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking to John Bauermaster, who is an adventurer and climber who's doing an Antarctic adventure, and he's going to be calling in from Chile, so we're going to find out what he is up to down on the other end of the globe here. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Hutchison. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Lisa Geip, who is the behavior manager there. Today, yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's the first Wednesday of the month. It's Animal Day. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Now, behavior manager, that's what we'd all like to do, is control the behaviors of those around us, especially our animals. What do you do? What do you do and how do you do it?
I do a lot of things there. The behavior part of it is I oversee the assessments of the dogs and cats that come into the shelter and help determine their adoptability and what type of homes we should put them in.
And how do you determine that?
We use a method, a test called the SAFER test, developed by Emily Weiss. She's an animal behaviorist, and it helps us kind of gauge some aggression, and it's a tool for us to, again, figure out what would be the best placement for a particular animal.
And so aggression is the main problem, and it's the main thing by which you sort out. It's not intelligence or cuteness or...
No, not at all. I mean... Aggression is our big focus, simply because we need to verify and make sure that the animals we put out are safe for our staff, volunteers, and the community.
So what about other kinds of behavior? Of course, being here and having two bad dogs and one good dog at home, I have to tell a brief story, which is that I'm taking care of the dog of a very small dog of a friend of mine who is sick, and my two little terriers, when that dog comes into the house, they want to eat it. Do you deal with that kind of behavior?
There are definitely protocols we can put in place to modify some behavior. Unfortunately, you can't modify all behavior, so sometimes you're looking at more of a management situation on certain behaviors.
So when can you really control it? When can you manage it? For example, in the case of, you've got dogs at home that are very good dogs most of the time, but they're very territorial, or what we call territorial.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of it is training, and training starts from the very beginning when you get your dog. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people wait until they're in a certain situation before they start training. If you've started training way before, you have a definite head start on managing your dog's behavior, controlling their reactions to certain things. So I really can't stress training enough in any situation. If you get a new dog and the dog is great and you're having no problems, it's definitely still a good idea to start training and just get some tools.
Do dogs like to be trained?
Absolutely, absolutely. A lot of breeds, you know, they're just looking for something to do. They're looking for some focus. They're looking for a job, basically.
And so... what if you don't really know how to train your dog? What do you suggest? You suggest going to classes, or can you really learn it from a book?
I think I would definitely suggest classes. I think you get a lot from the interaction with instructors and watching other people work with their dogs and just being out and exposing your dog to other situations. I mean, you can watch shows on TV, you can read books and stuff, but I think to see it in practice with a trainer showing you really makes a difference.
There's an unbelievable variety of dog trainers in Santa Fe. The shelter does its own dog behavior classes, and there are tons of other dog trainers, some really spectacular trainers in our community. So anybody who hasn't taken the time, we talk about this sometimes, the old dog and new tricks idea, that... even if you can't necessarily start from 6 weeks old and work on up, if you encounter a dog at 6 years old, there's still a lot of things that you can do to help the dog and help yourself unwind. You know, some of us don't have our first therapy session until we're 35 years old, and goodness, that's helpful still.
Well, we need to accumulate enough baggage to have something to talk about.
Yeah, a six-year-old lab definitely has enough baggage to give you something to talk about.
Yes. Well, certain TV dog trainers who shall remain nameless can take dogs that are not young at all and you know, integrate them into the good dog pack.
Yes, yes, they definitely can. And I would just remind folks that when you're seeing stuff on TV, you're seeing very edited versions of that, and the process can be a lot more intense and labor-intensive than what you're seeing on that show.
I've learned a lot about dog vocabulary over the years from Lisa. She and I have worked together for about 5 years now. And it's hard sometimes to watch some of those dog training shows because what you're being told by the narrator that you are seeing is not what the dog's body vocabulary is necessarily telling you sometimes. And that can be a difficult thing to watch. But it's very interesting to realize that you do know a few things about dog vocabulary. And a lot of it we talk about sometimes at the shelter is learning to speak your dog's language, learning to understand what they're telling you. And when you do, it's like a whole new world opens up sometimes in the relationship with the animal.
What are some examples of dog vocabulary?
Let's see, like body postures and stuff. You know, I think a lot of times we see a wagging tail and you assume the dog is friendly. But the positioning of the tail can really mean a lot, whether it's up high and going really fast or whether it's down and looking more relaxed.
For example, what do those two things tell you?
A dog with its tail up over its back going really fast would tell me that dog is aroused. That dog is very alert to things that are going on around it. If there was another dog present.
But it's usually happy, happy kind of alert, no?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Some of the things are very subtle. A more relaxed dog, you see the tail down. You see it, you know, low, wagging kind of slowly. The high alert tail. Again, I mean, there's some real subtleties there, but they can all mean different things.
I can tell you a couple of examples of watching people interact with dogs at the dog park and seeing somebody who sees, 50-pound New Mexico brown dog with his tail up wagging and doing that thing that we humans tend to do, which is kind of crouch over the dog with our hand outstretched, moving toward it quickly to say hello, which for a dog that's suddenly hyperstimulated and this person is coming toward it, lording over it like that, it can be a terrifying situation or be the thing that sets the dog to the other side of the mood switch that it was on. And that's some of the importance, the tremendous importance of learning behavior. And behavior departments in shelters, 20 years ago, you hardly saw such a thing. But now, in really contemporary progressive shelters, a behavior department is a must. And it's an interesting acknowledgement of the complexities of animal psychology.
It's interesting. I mean, what you were just talking about was people vocabulary. Dogs respond very much to the gestures of people.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that people should know about how dogs are going to interpret them?
It's just like when I watch people walk through our kennels and I watch people sometimes just walk straight up to a kennel, open kennel, and they're standing right over a dog, that can be very threatening for a dog. The people may, of course, they don't mean anything. You know, they're just trying to be friendly. They're trying to look at the dog and reach out to the dog. But that can be very, very threatening for a dog.
If a 25-foot creature suddenly loomed over you.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Things like hats, things like, pay attention to how your voice is when you speak to a dog, you know.
It is funny. My dachshund barks at men in hats.
Uh-huh, yeah.
What's up with that?
It's just dogs, more than anything, do react to men with hats and facial hair. You know, what it means
like
to them.
They don't like it, necessarily.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what it means to them, but in the kennel situation, we have seen a lot of reaction like that. So.
One of the things that I find interesting, we do tours with a lot of kids, kids groups, and kids have this tendency to want to pat a dog on the head, on the top of the head, which is that's not a positive thing for a dog. That's a dominance. How would you explain that?
It's a bit invasive, you know. I mean, dogs don't touch people accidentally. When a dog touches you, I mean, there's an intent behind it. So a person walking up to a dog and just, boom, putting their hand right on top of the head can be a very threatening gesture for a dog and not at all enjoyable.
What if the time comes where you need to really dominate your dog, as I've been dealing with as they try to, attack this poor, sweet little poodle thing that's in my house?
Yeah. You know, at the shelter in our training classes, our focus is primarily on positive reinforcement and stuff. And we don't usually talk about how to necessarily have to discipline your dog or dominate your dog or teach it something. Again, that's where the training comes in from very early on, and just really positive reinforcement, getting your dog's attention, you know, using treats as opposed to having to, you know, jump and say, hey, stop that, you know, stuff like that. We really focus on the positive and less
now,
of discipline.
Do you have dogs?
Yes.
So they never do bad things? You've trained them so well?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, again, what I've learned, particularly from our trainer at the shelter, is positive reinforcement and getting my dog to listen to me, you know, recall stuff and everything. I mean, screaming at the dog as he's running towards a rabbit doesn't help, you know. But if I have a good recall, if my dog has been trained to know that if he comes to me, I probably have a treat in my pocket, things like that.
But, I mean, a smart dog will say, okay, rabbit, treat. I prefer the rabbit. I know the treat is good, but the rabbit's better.
Yeah. You know, it obviously can be a really difficult choice for a dog. You know, obviously. You know, the trainer at the shelter would say that it certainly can be done to call animals off chasing something that intently. But it is a difficult choice. I don't have that.
The thing we remember is that, you know, there's no, like, flawless training program for any animal, the same way that there's no, like, one way of educating the youth of America that makes them productive, contributive members of society. So there's no secret trick to making sure that your dog always comes back. But certainly instilling good habits and rewarding positive behavior tends to make a dog more interested in doing the stuff you want it to do. Because there's no profit, there's no productivity in doing these other things. But, you know, the same way an honors student will, you know, occasionally go get loaded in the sand dunes over the weekend, sometimes your dog will chase the rabbit.
Now, cat and training are not two words that you usually hear in the same sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
Usually they're bloody people that are using them in the same sentence. Very bloody people.
Cats are definitely a little more complicated as far as figuring them out and managing their behavior. Again, personally, I feel with cats, you kind of live with a cat and you kind of manage its behavior and you kind of accept certain things about a cat.
So you at least train them to use the litter box.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of an instinctual thing. They do like to bury their stool and stuff like that. So, I mean, you can help them along, give them a little push here and there in the right direction. But for the most part, they figure a lot of things out on their own.
Now, what else does the behavior department do at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter?
We interact a lot with a lot of other rescue groups and a lot of other shelters. If we feel that we cannot place a dog safely in our adoption kennels for some reason, we work with a wide network of other shelters and specific breed rescue groups to find a placement for that dog. That kind of falls in with part of our transfer program. We also oversee that, and that entails bringing animals in from other shelters, particularly southern New Mexico shelters that get a lot of animals in, yet don't have a large, I would say, customer base of people coming in to adopt.
Most of our small dogs come from a group that we partner with in Mexico, Save a Mexican Mutt. So we have a tremendous number of Chihuahua mixes and small terriers and whatnot that come up from Mexico as well, and this transfer program, our Traveling Tails program, is one of my favorite things. I was just doing our year-end numbers for our annual report. We brought in over 500 dogs from other shelters and rescue groups, and were able to transfer out just over 300 animals. So these are animals that were not finding homes in the place they were at, whether it was our shelter or another shelter, and they got a second chance because of this. I think you're seeing this more and more with shelters all over the country, this collaborative interest. Rather than recognizing themselves as competitors for donor dollars, they see themselves, and certainly we in Santa Fe see ourselves this way, united in a collaborative effort to save animals, control over population, and create a more humane society. And it's very, I think these transfer programs, behavior programs, you see a unique shift in animal welfare over the change from the 20th to the 21st century. Even in that short amount of time, there's been radical, radical progressions.
Very interesting. There's also a northward migration, animals moving from Mexico and southern New Mexico to northern New Mexico and then to Colorado.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like the swallows of San Juan Capistrano.
Right. Only it's always summer where they move, where they
exactly.
go north.
And the dogs build much bigger mud huts than the swallows do.
I know my dogs do. So what kind of animals do you have up for adoption right now?
We actually still have a number of small dogs, which there's some really great ones. You know, at the shelter, we try to stick with a universal shelter vocabulary. So when shelters talk to each other, they actually know what each other are saying. And we have a classification of behavior dogs called treatable, manageable. And these are things that, like Lisa was talking about, it's not necessarily something that you can completely conquer, but a behavior that you can definitely manage. And there's a number of small dogs, I think, that tend to exhibit these treatable, manageable behaviors. And they make amazing companions for the person who's willing to actually take the time to listen to what our behavior staff has come up with and implement and be consistent. And some of these dogs are just unbelievable.
What kind of dogs?
A lot of terriers and chihuahua mixes right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those did come in through the transfer program. The advantage of the transfer program is, you know, we are able to, with our transfer partners, work with them, and they will send us dogs that they really, really think will work well in our shelter.
And so many people want small dogs because they live in apartments or small houses of one kind or another.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So we definitely try to get a good variety for people coming in, you know, so they're not seeing the same 70-pound brown dog in every kennel as they walk through.
Which is named Bear.
Exactly. Yeah, either Bear or Oso. One of the other things I wanted to mention about our behavior department is the behavior helpline. This is something that has been around at the shelter for a long, long time, but not everybody knows about it. If you are whether you have a shelter animal or not, if you call our free behavior helpline, you can talk to one of our behavior staff, and they will give you some really good ideas on how to work through your issue. And whether it's a cat question, a dog question, a hedgehog question, you can give a call. And if they don't know the answer, they're incredibly good about tracking down the information using this vast network of really intelligent, committed people to try and find an answer.
Lisa's shaking her head and saying, I don't do hedgehogs.
Lisa Absolutely. Doesn't do hedgehogs. Lisa, I want to tell you a funny story about Lisa. She can handle the meanest dog. I mean, it's unbelievable. She just can go in and get it under control. But if you show her a 1-inch long snake or perhaps an injured hummingbird in a box, she will climb the wall, run out of the building, but faced with the nastiest Shar-Pei pit bull mix, he'll be eating out of her hand and she will be completely fearless.
Amazing, amazing. What do you think are the easiest and hardest dog breeds to train?
Oh, that's a tough question. I would say, I'm not sure what I would say the easiest. I've seen some really amazing pit bulls that respond really well to work and training. I've seen some really, really difficult chihuahuas who you think you could have under control, you know, no problem. So I think that's a tough question to answer.
I've never seen an easy to train chihuahua.
Really? We get some pretty
good
ones. They
seem to have
definitely.
A mind of their own, a collective mind of their own.
Sometimes they do, but we've had really good luck with them so far.
I think about, you know, Alvin, one of our behavior evaluators, has a poodle mix?
He is a poodle mix, 10-year-old poodle.
Who, she has worked with him, and she's an incredibly talented behavior person, and that dog is really just a hair's breadth away from snapping at all times. She can manage him, but, I mean, that's an example of sometimes unfixable is such a loaded word, but sometimes...
How about bad?
Sometimes they're so set in their ways that it takes a lot of very particular attention to manage it. And certainly our behavior evaluator and her dog have a partnership, but she manages it a lot by not exposing him to things that are going to set him off. She knows what his stimuli are.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how did you get into the whole dog training world?
I started you know, as an animal care technician, cleaning kennels and just working with animals and stuff. And
10 years ago?
Closer to 13, actually.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And in the beginning, you were starting to see more, more shelters noting behavior and really trying to be aware of the type of animals they were putting out. And when that whole movement started, I just kind of followed with it. Just going to seminars, just, you know, conferences, just learning all I could about the different things.
As somebody who's good at it, how do you describe the qualities that are needed to be good at training dogs?
I guess I would say good instincts and
animal instincts,
exactly. Sometimes you can look at a dog and you really need to be aware of your gut feeling. I mean, we test every animal that comes in, and, you know, we have on paper what we saw and everything. But I think you really can't discount a gut feeling when you look at a dog, how it makes you feel. I mean, I've had dogs that I've sat next to in a kennel, and I have just felt like I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And it wasn't a particular thing I could put my finger on, but it was just a feeling. Yet I've seen dogs cowering and growling in the back of the kennel and been able to walk up and just, you know, put my hands on them, and they're fine, you know. It's hard to explain, but I think gut feeling goes a long way with myself and my staff.
You watch a good behavior evaluator, and it's really stunning. I've been very emotionally moved sometimes watching Lisa and her two staff members interacting with animals, because with an animal there's not this reflectivity. It's not as though a dog looks at another dog and thinks to itself, his ears are laid back and his teeth are slightly bared, and I wonder, you know, in the moment I think an animal knows exactly what it's reading. And these behavior staff, you watch them and it's very clear that their connection with these animals is strong enough that absolutely, that it's not a good hunch. They are absolutely instinctually reading the behavior of this animal. And that's a powerful thing to see in animal welfare.
And it is something that if you try hard enough, you can learn.
You can definitely learn the process. You can definitely learn the process. Again, when I hire people, I really look for how they respond to a dog and how a dog responds to them. And just kind of their natural ability. I think you do need some natural ability around animals.
I think you have to be, just from watching animal behaviorists, you have to just be really aware of yourself, I think. You have to be very conscious of what you're doing, and a good behaviorist tends to be a pretty good listener to humans as well, I find, because they look for these subtle details that indicate things that will give them information about the person or the other creature they're interacting with.
Well, it is actually time to go. Lisa Geip is the behavior manager at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, where Bill works also. And Bill is with us, Bill Hutchison, every first Wednesday of the month. Lisa, if people want to find out more or call that hotline, what's the number?
They can reach us at 983-4309, extension 230.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Charlotte.
And we're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone from Chile, John Bauermaster. He's an adventurer, climber, kayaker, explorer, and he is on an Antarctic adventure. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, hello, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you here. By the way, we're going to be doing a DVD giveaway of some of the kayaking videos that John Bauermaster has made in a little while toward the end of the show. I watched a couple of your videotapes last night, or DVDs, and one was about kayaking in a two-man boat in the Aleutian Islands. How did you find yourself doing this?
Well, you know, we've just come back from Antarctica, which is the end of a 10-year-long project where we've literally been taking sea kayaks and traveling around the world one continent at a time. And the very first trip we did was the one you speak of in the Aleutian Islands, you know, that chain of islands that hangs like a necklace between Russia and Alaska. And I think, you know, 10 years ago the motivation was kind of adventure for adventure's sake, but the project has evolved over the years so that now we've, for the last seven expeditions, we've really been taking a close look at both the health of the seas and the lives of people who depend on them around the world.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there's a cultural angle to these DVDs and an environmental angle as well. And one of the things that was interesting about the Aleutian one was that the Aleut people were the ultimate expert kayakers. What were their lives like and what were their kayaks like?
Mary Charlotte, I believe we've lost our guest. I'm sorry. And he'll probably try to call right back. Let me see if I can get him.
All right. And maybe we'll hear just a little bit of music or an announcement of some kind. You're listening to KSFR 101.1 FM. And for those of you who are listening on the frequency 90.7 FM, we hope you are retuning your radio dials to 101.1 FM, which is our new home and will be our new home into the glorious future. We are also, of course, on the internet, streaming at ksfr.org. And this show is archived on santafe.radiocafe.org.
Do we have... I believe we do.
All right.
Oh, good.
Oh, good. You're back. What I was going to say...
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, the Aleutian people, the Aleut people, they were great kayakers. What were their kayaks like, and what were their lives like? When you were at these islands, there was nobody there now.
No one lives in the Aleutians currently, but, you know, the great thing about the Aleuts is their population goes back several thousand years out there. And, you know, any of your listeners who are familiar with kayaks, I mean, they have those early Aleuts to thank for the design of the kayaks we still use today, although theirs, of course, were quite different. The fabrics they used for the exterior were seal skins, and the interior were whale bones, whereas today we use, you know, fiberglass and carbon fiber and Kevlar, etc. But the craft itself is very, very similar.
So, and what were their lives like? What did they eat, and why are they no longer there?
Well, the Aleuts were obviously totally marine-based culture, because these islands where they lived, there were no mammals. The only food they had came from the sea, which meant that they were forced to go out in these what were then very small boats, kind of 12 and 13 feet long, and hunt seals and even whales from these boats. Everything they had, even their salads and et cetera, came from the sea. And the reason they're no longer there is, you know, over the course of the last couple hundred years, going back to the early 1700s, they were basically enslaved by both American and Russian and later Japanese sealers who came through to hunt the seals and then took advantage of the Aleuts' incredible skills on the water and as hunters. The last Aleuts to live out in the Aleutians, of course, were in the early 1940s, just at the onset of World War II, when the Japanese invaded the Aleutian Islands. The government moved the remaining Aleuts out of the Aleutian Islands and back to kind of mainland Alaska.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. You not only go kayaking, but you do things that I cannot even contemplate, like climbing up windy, icy volcanoes that emit poisonous smoke. Why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of our projects are based at sea level. So anytime we can get a little perspective, we climb something, whether it's a volcano or a mountain or, you know, in the case of French Polynesia, where we went amongst these coral reef atolls spread through the South Pacific, we would stop on these little atolls and climb the church steeples just to give us some elevation so that we could get a sense of really where we were. Because when you're traveling by sea kayak just at sea level, your kind of grand horizon is pretty limited.
Now, some parts of the adventures that you go on are not so much fun. I mean, there's some footage of you and your colleagues basically trapped inside of your tiny little tents, you know, in rainstorms with 70-mile-an-hour winds going outside. Does that happen often?
Well, that happened a lot in the Aleutian Islands. You know, that part of the world is literally known as the birthplace of the winds. But keep in mind that these expeditions over the last decade have taken us to such a variety of places and cultures. You know, we went down the coast of Vietnam, which obviously there were many, many, many hundreds and thousands of people we saw every day. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, we went through the islands of Croatia, which compared to some of our trips was very civilized in that many of the islands we went to actually had small villages on them. So, you know, every one of them is quite different. We've just come back from Antarctica, which is a place where virtually no one lives. I mean, there's a handful of scientists working down there. We saw some tourist boats, but again, you know, each of the trips is different, and some of them are a little more arduous than others.
What is the nature of your Antarctic adventure? What is your mission?
Well, we've just returned. We were down there for 5 weeks, and our goal was to go have a look at the Antarctic Peninsula. You know, if you think of Antarctica as kind of fist-sized, the peninsula sticks out like a thumb, and it's exposed out in the ocean, the Southern Ocean, which means that the temperatures there are compared to the rest of Antarctica are more moderate. And we went at the height of summer as a way to be able to talk about how the peninsula of Antarctica is changing, both due to climate change, warmer air temperatures, and also because of the impact of tourism. I mean, I think this year 40,000 people will visit the peninsula of Antarctica by cruise boat, and you know they're going to a relatively small piece of Antarctica, and our curiosity was how are they impacting both the wildlife and this place.
And what did you find?
Well, you know, we traveled by sea kayak and sailboat, and we covered several hundred miles. In regard to climate change, I mean, we had a couple weeks of extremely beautiful blue sky days where temperatures were in the 30s, even into the low 40s Fahrenheit. And then that was followed by a week of very steady and occasionally torrential rain. And when most people think of Antarctica, they don't think of rain, right? They think of ice and snow. And rain is a very bad thing for this part of Antarctica, in part because it helps degrade the ice even faster, helps melt the ice even faster, but also its impact on wildlife, particularly these young penguin chicks. You know, all the young penguin chicks are born right around the 1st of December, and by the 1st of February, right about now, they're all ready to leave the nest. But during that, you know, during January, when we saw all these rains, most of the chicks were still covered in down. And you know what happens to down when it gets wet? It's very hard to dry out. So the concern there and what we witnessed was that these young penguin chicks would get soaked by the rain, then the weather would change back to kind of more typical Antarctica cold, and they would freeze and not be able to and not survive.
And did you witness penguin chicks dying that way?
Yeah, we did. We saw it. But, you know, that's part of the ebb and flow of nature. I mean, animals, just like humans, die all the time. But this is, you know, if you believe that climate change is in part due to man's contribution to the warming atmosphere, I mean, this is an example of how climate change impacts a place, both its natural setting and the wildlife.
You also...
That said, you know, Antarctica... I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Now that said, I mean, Antarctica is still a big, tough, rugged place. I mean, during our travels along the peninsula, you're traveling along a long line of tall, snow-capped mountain peaks with, you know, that run down to glaciers going on to the sea. So it's still a big, beautiful, dramatic place. I don't want to paint it as some kind of hell or anything.
Well, you also saw the quite a bit of melting of the ice and its effects. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, along that side of the peninsula, that's where the scientists who work the peninsula are based. And we stopped at several science bases and got kind of anecdotal and scientific example from them as to exactly how that part of the world is changing. We stopped at an American base where they were able to go out and point to glaciers that were just behind their base that had receded by 30 feet in the last 10 years, exposing something they had never expected was there, which was a rocky island, which had been covered by snow and ice for hundreds of thousands of years. We stopped at a Ukrainian base called Vernadsky, where the guys there who are based there, you know, year-round, told us that this year, in particular, the channel between their island and the mainland didn't freeze as solidly as it has in the past, which meant they couldn't go across it on foot as they usually do. We stopped on a tiny little island called Peterman, where a trio of penguin researchers work, and they talked about how the penguin colonies and penguin populations are changing because some of the penguins prefer colder environment and prefer to spend their time on pack ice. And as there's less pack ice in that particular area, obviously that species of penguin had moved further south. So we saw lots and lots of evidence.
You bring up the question on your website of whether anyone owns Antarctica. What's the answer to that?
Well, Antarctica is actually a very unique place in that it's governed pretty successfully by international treaty. You know, going back to, I think the treaty was formalized in 1957, 1958. And since then, there are I think 29 countries with science bases in Antarctica, and in total, 46 countries have signed the Antarctic Treaty, which makes it off limits to both exploitation, you know, looking for minerals and oil and things, and it also means that the military is not supposed to be there. So it's supposed to be a peaceful place. A few years ago, actually, in 1991, the debate was, should we just turn Antarctica into a giant world park? And that wasn't done, but still, until the year 2041, Antarctica will remain off limits to all exploitation and military, which again makes it very unique in the world.
Who were the first human beings to visit Antarctica?
Well, I mean, it has been spied by some of the very first sailors going back to Magellan. But no one landed there until, I believe, kind of the mid to late 1800s. And then, of course, by the early 1900s, many of the world's great explorers from Australia, from Spain, from the United Kingdom, were all heading down there, of course, trying to establish some sort of territorial claim, but also to do those great firsts, like, you know, be the first to reach the South Pole.
We're talking to John Bauermaster. Now, you were talking about not only the effects of climate change, but the effects of tourism. And I guess there are quite a lot of tourist ships circling around Antarctica. What kind of effect are they having, and what kind of other touristic effect do you see?
Well, you know, I think in the course of the weeks we were there, we saw probably a dozen big tourist ships ranging from 100 passengers to 500 passengers. We didn't see it, but I know that in January there was one of those big Princess Cruise Line boats that went down there to visit. And, you know, they carry more than 3,000 passengers. The big ships don't land anyone. You know, they don't put anyone on land. They just kind of come down. People take pictures of icebergs from the deck of the ships and then return to the tip of South America. The smaller ships, including the 500-passenger one, they land all of their people. So the real question is, you know, what kind of impact is that tourism having on the continent? You know, we were down there for scouting purposes in November when the tourist ship sank, and we actually were the first on the scene to watch those people be rescued. And it gives you it's very eye-opening to think about, tourists being afloat on the Southern Ocean in lifeboats. You know, in November it was just 150 people, but imagine if one of those Princess Cruise Lines hits an iceberg by accident and goes down. All of a sudden you've got 3,000 passengers, another 1,500 persons in the crew needing to be rescued. And how do you do that off the coast of Antarctica? That'd be very tricky, if not impossible. So, you know, there are great concerns about Antarctica. I mean, the treaty members meet every year to talk about how it might be amended or changed, and I'm sure that this year when they meet over the summertime, the big subject's going to be tourism.
So we're talking to John Bauermaster. Now, were there a lot of other adventurers like you? I mean, the kind of thing you do, sailing around in icy waters and climbing volcanoes and stuff, that's not something your average tourist is going to do.
No. That's not typical. You know, the treaty says that any private expedition that goes down there to Antarctica has to provide its own search and rescue. You know, there is no Navy, there's no Coast Guard, there's no police. So if you go down there and get in trouble, there's no one to call. So that's one reason we took the sailboat, because we needed to be self-sufficient so that if there was a problem, we could take care of ourselves. But no, you don't see a lot of private expeditions in Antarctica. Still, you know, each year there are more and more people going, and, you know, tourists flying to the South Pole, climbers going to Mount Vincent, which is the tallest peak on the continent, I think. More than 100 people this year climbed Mount Vincent in the heart of Antarctica. So it's a place that's attracting more and more people, which is a reason that it also needs to attract more and more attention and observation and scientific study, just so that, you know, it still is this very pristine frontier, but I'm a firm believer that it needs lots and lots of research still.
You have been making a lot of documentaries. What is it like to go on adventures with the intention of making documentaries as opposed to just going for its own sake?
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer that there's plenty of room in the world for adventure's sake. People go out and climb mountains for the first time or do the descents of rivers for the first time. And over the years, you know, in the past, I've participated in lots of those kinds of expeditions. But these trips we do are slightly different in that I really feel it's important that we bring back a story to share. And so we've been making films from each of our expeditions. And, you know, the film you talked about, the Aleutian Island film, is a very fun and beautiful film. It continues to get great audience reception around the world. But that was a trip we did in 1999. But so the ability to have those films and have them out there, you know, you if you watched it, you wouldn't know if it was 1999 or last year. And that's kind of irrelevant. It's just, they're just really, I think, interesting stories about very kind of unique, out-of-the-way parts of the world that are important to tell. You know, in Antarctica, we were very concerned about making a big, beautiful film about this part of the world because really, relative to the 6.7 billion people on the planet, relatively few people will ever get to see the Antarctic in person. So one of our main focuses was on bringing back a beautiful film to share.
In all of your adventures, what's the scariest situation or situations that you've ever been in?
Well, I mean, one of the things I pride ourselves on is being very careful and prudent and patient, et cetera. So we try not to get into positions where we're in trouble. But, you know, that said, I mean, anytime you look around, I mean, when we just came back from Antarctica, you know, you cross the Drake Passage, which is one of the windiest pieces of water in the world. And, you know, any false step, any, you know, kind of inattention, and, you know, if you end up in that water, you know, you're dead. I mean, there's no real option of the boat turning around or coming back for you or anything like that. So, and the same with any time you do the kayak expeditions on the cold water, you have to be extremely conscientious because if you end up in those cold waters, I mean, in Antarctica, the water temperature was just below freezing, about 30 degrees Fahrenheit. That's, you know, because of all the salt in the water. But, you know, the human body is obviously not conditioned to survive in those waters. So we're very careful when we're in those conditions.
Was there any moment that stood out to you where you thought, oh, boy, here comes the end?
No. I have to admit, I haven't had that moment yet. No, I mean, and also, you know, when we were on land in Antarctica, even though it was often windy and wet, we were there at the height of summer, so the conditions weren't as bad as typically Antarctica can be. And again, we were on the peninsula, which is warmed by the fact that it's buffered on either side by the ocean, which warms it. You know, the tricky thing about Antarctica is generalizing. You can't generalize about Antarctica. You can't say Antarctica is warming or Antarctica is getting colder because parts of Antarctica are getting warmer, but simultaneously parts of Antarctica are recording record cold temperatures. So I think people have to be careful when they generalize about any environmental issue.
Let's talk for a moment about Croatia because that was the other DVD that I was able to watch, and you went kayaking in Croatia, and I was expecting this big kayaking video, but it was really much more of a cultural piece about life there, and particularly about fishing.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we've been able to accomplish with this 10-year-long project is we've come away with a really unique look at the world's oceans and the lives of people who depend on them, and we've been able to identify, you know, a trio of environmental issues that impact all the people who live near the sea, whether they wake up in the morning off the coast of Vietnam or the coast of Croatia or the coast of Chile, and that is, you know, the impact of climate change, pollution, especially plastic pollution, and the one then that you saw highlighted in that Croatia film, overfishing. I mean, here was one trip where I thought we were going to be totally self-sufficient. We would just buy fish from small fishermen every day and not have to carry a lot of food with us. And I think during the course of 5 weeks or 6 weeks, we were able to buy fish from a fisherman just on one occasion. And that's because that Adriatic there between Italy and Croatia is so overfished by the big international fishing companies that the small family fisherman has a really tough time. So, you know, we got over there and we saw that, and mm-hmm. that became kind of the driving force of the film. The kayaks are kayaks are something that draws people to the story. We use them to get us to places we might not easily get to otherwise. But, you know, these things are not really kayak films as much as they are culture and environmental and kind of adventure travel films.
You spoke just a moment ago about pollution, especially plastic pollution. Is that what you said?
Yes. Yep.
Tell us about the particular nature and danger of plastic pollution.
Well, I mean, you've been on beaches around the world, I'm sure, and you know, it's hard sometimes to walk on beaches and not find evidence of man. You know, we've been on beaches, remote beaches in Africa, some super remote beaches on islands far off the mainland of Croatia, and you come up and there's plastic kind of ankle to calf deep that's washed up from around the world. And the great irony or truth in what you see washed up on shore is that it represents just a small percentage of the plastic that's still in the ocean. You know, we have a tendency to think that when we take things to the garbage and throw it away, that means it's out of sight, out of mind. But oftentimes around the world, a lot of that garbage still ends up in the sea. A lot of the big ships working around the world still treat the ocean like a big garbage dump. So, you know, there's even though, you know, the ocean is big, it's not this finite waste dump that we can use for the rest of our lives. It needs to be treated pretty carefully, and the evidence of it not being treated carefully is that plastic you see washed up on beaches around the world.
What's it like to go back to civilization after you do one of your kayaking adventures?
Well, it feels good. We're back at the tip of Chile now, and we for the first time in several weeks have a nice warm breeze, which is nice. You know, but when you're back, of course, you start thinking about what's next. That's part of the beauty of this life.
And how can people see these DVDs? I mean, we're going to do a giveaway in just a few moments, but are they on TV?
Well, yeah, you know, ironically, all of that whole series has been broadcast by the National Geographic Channel, but only around the world. I think they've played in 140 countries, but not yet in the United States.
Good heavens.
I'd say stay tuned. No, not yet. You know, they've shown in lots of film festivals around the country, and that you can see them all at my website at thejohnbauermaster.com. And, you know, also we've done great both video and text and photographs from our recent Antarctica trip are all up online, too. So I think that's kind of a fun source, too.
Well, John Bauermaster, I want to thank you so much for talking to us. You're all the way down in Chile, and this has been wonderful to have you on the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thank you very much.
And John Bauermaster is an adventurer, climber, kayaker, explorer, documentary maker, and he is on an Antarctic adventure, or just finishing an Antarctic adventure right now. We are going to right now give away 4 copies of DVDs by John Bauermaster, and 2 of them are Birthplace of the Winds, Sea Kayaking in Alaska, and the other 2 are Borderland, Sea Kayaking in Croatia. So if you call right now, 428-1382, you can get one of these DVDs. The trick is you have to be able to come in at some point between 8 and 9:30 in the morning to the Santa Fe Bacon Company to pick it up in person. So if you are into that, give us a call, 428-1382. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the monthly Women in Jazz show. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.